Secretary Kissinger and I arrived in Israel on the same day. We traveled in slightly different circles. My circle was bounded by Jerusalem and the Galilee, Haifa, Beersheba, Tel Aviv. And his was a jet-bounding circle. Aswan, Amman, Damascus, Riyadh, even a short side trip to Ankara to solve the problems of Cyprus. But I must say that now that I'm home and that he's on his way home, I at least have something of a suntan to show for it. When I was in Israel, the most urgent question which was put to me had to do with the nature of Dr. Kissinger. Who was he? What was he really like? And parenthetically, I was intrigued by the fact that I was never once asked, what kind of person is Gerald Ford? It was always, who is Henry Kissinger? What kind of person is he really? Suspicion comes easily and naturally to Israelis. We wouldn't expect it to be otherwise. After all, there's hardly an Israeli who hasn't stood in front of some government official in Europe, North Africa, the Middle East, and been promised help, the return of expropriated property, an exit visa, help to save his life or that of someone in his family, and known that that bureaucrat was lying through his teeth. It's well to remember that Israel is peopled not only by those who have known the angry blast of the Hitlers and the Stalins of the world, evil. It's also peopled by those who were turned down by the officers of the American embassies in Berlin, Warsaw, Bucharest, Rome, when they applied in the 1930s for entry papers to the West, to the United States, or to England, France. They have good reason to know that diplomats are master liars and that they use noble words to cover up the limitations of their power or their calculated indifference. What is surprising is that suspicion about Henry Kissinger came so tardily to the Israelis. This was my third trip to Israel in the last 12 months. And during the first two of these trips, I found the Israelis defending Henry Kissinger to me. They were saying, in effect, he's unser uns, he's one of us. Oh, we know he's not religious. We know he doesn't take part in the organized Jewish community of the United States. But he's known what it meant to be a Jew in Germany. And once you know that, somehow you can be trusted to know why there is a Jewish state and why that state must be maintained in strength. Somehow the fact that Kissinger came of German Jewish stock, that his family had fled before Hitler to these United States, that he himself had been in our army of occupation in Germany after the Second World War, and that he had seen firsthand the evidence of the concentration camps. Somehow all this meant a great deal to the Israeli. They felt that Mr. Kissinger could be trusted. They knew the issues were complicated and the hates were piled high, and they were willing to put their trust in him. And this lack of suspicion in the early months of this year was compounded by the pronouncements of the new Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin. Mr. Rabin, as you well know, had been Israel's ambassador to Nixon's Washington. One of his claims to rank upon his return to Israel once the Meir government had been toppled in last year's elections was that he was on good terms with the Republican administration, particularly with Dr. Kissinger. And he made a great deal in his speeches and in his private conversation to Mr. Rabin about what he used to call the identity of interest between Israel and the United States. An identity of interest which went beyond values, philosophy, democracy, went to the hard, calculated interests of policy. He was wont to say that just as Israel needed the strength of America in the international arena, so America needed the security of air bases in Israel, of Israel's well-equipped and well-trained army in the Middle East. That somehow the armor, the air power of Israel, was a support to American concerns about Iran. And somehow the involvement of the United States in Israel and in Jordan precluded the poor Arabs of the north, of Iraq and Syria, Palestinians from moving down and subverting the rich oil lands, Saudi Arabia and the Persian Gulf states. And this thesis, promoted to a large degree by Mr. Rabin, became very popular in Israel. He made a great deal of the fact that there had been the continuing airlift of American supplies to Israel during the Yom Kippur War, Mr. Kissinger's role in that airlift despite the oil embargo, and he made very little of the nearly four-day delay before America had been willing to undertake the airlift and Mr. Kissinger's role in that delay. Mr. Rabin made a great deal of Mr. Kissinger's willingness to promote foreign aid to Israel after the Yom Kippur War. The State Department actively championed in Congress the $2.1 billion aid bill, which was passed in November a year ago. And he made very little of Mr. Kissinger's angry protest to Israel during the last days of the Yom Kippur War against the complete encirclement of the besieged Egyptian Third Army east of the Suez Canal. Somehow, Mr. Rabin found ways of entwining his political fate, moving towards the forefront of political power in Israel with the power, the manifest power of Dr. Kissinger, for he manifests the power of these United States. And given this kind of leadership in Israel, given the thirst for peace, which is sensed by every Israeli, given the tensions of the area, given the fact that there seemed no other practical solution but to trust Dr. Kissinger, the Israelis allowed their native suspicions to lie dormant. And when during those first round negotiations of, in the fall of last year, and Dr. Kissinger told them that you must not only pull back from the canal to the mountain range of Sinai, something that Israel had long been prepared to do, but that you must give back Kunetra and land on the Golan Heights. You must enter into a variety of agreements with the Arab world, despite the fact that they are not at this point willing to make concessions to you. But you can trust me. I will see to it that they live up to their part of the bargain. I will see to it that arms continue to flow from the United States to Israel, so that you'll have at least 3 weeks of armor, equipment, in case of another war. I will see to it that aid is sponsored on your behalf. All of this proved to be a persuasive argument. And against the better judgment of some, Israel was willing to settle last fall for these private assurances, the promises of American help, and not to press with too much determination for political arrangements. For the ultimate trade-off in the Middle East must be land for peace, land for direct negotiations. That's been clear from the beginning. In that first round, Dr. Kissinger could not produce peace, direct negotiations. Perhaps he would in the second round. Between the fall of last year and March of this year, the beginning of this now aborted second round negotiations, the Israelis watched as America, through the State Department, through Dr. Kissinger, made much over much of Mr. Sadat's various statements about the possibilities of peace, how America played down his unwillingness to enter into political negotiations with Israel, how America said very little about what was said in the second and third paragraphs of all of Mr. Sadat's speeches. There had to be a settlement of all the outstanding issues in the Middle East, a return of all the Arab lands, a solution to all of the demands of the Palestinians before there could be direct negotiations, recognition, non-belligerency, and peace. Israel watched. And Israel wondered. Israel wondered at where America understood its interests now to lie. The oil states are with her. What did even-handedness really mean? She saw that America was not willing to take effective action against Saudi Arabia in the matter of discrimination against Jews. She saw that the Secretary of State of the United States was unwilling to demand that Saudi Arabia openly and easily accept all correspondence accredited to him on his various visits. On his first visit, he requested the Jewish correspondents on the press plane to remain aboard when the plane landed in Riyadh. They refused. And as a counterpoint to this, the Israelis now see the foreign minister of Holland, Mr. Van Zyl, who had hoped to go to Riyadh to see various people there about oil and such matters, who when the Saudis told him that he was welcome but that there could not be any Jew among the reporters who accompanied him, canceled his visit. Kissinger went. Van der Zyl stayed. Kissinger embraced Sadat, and the Israelis began to wonder. And the native suspicions began to arise. They were suspicious of Mr. Kissinger, and they were suspicious of their own leadership, of their strength, of how much they had intertwined their own fortunes with that of Dr. Kissinger. And so before he arrived in Israel 2 weeks ago. They won from Mr. Rabin the public assurance that before any arrangements were made which had to do with the West Bank, there would be a referendum of these arrangements by the Israeli electorate. And they won from him the promise that there would be open cabinet debate of any and all proposals submitted by the Americans. It was clear before Dr. Kissinger arrived in the Middle East, this time Israel would demand quid pro quo, that there would have to be some kind of political arrangement in return for the mountain passes and the oil fields of the Sinai. And it was also clear before Dr. Kissinger arrived that Mr. Sadat was unwilling to pledge non-belligerency, or to make any strong statement which might be interpreted in this manner. There were to be no open borders, there was to be no end to the boycott machinery, there was to be no open trade, there was to be no declaration of non-belligerency. Sadat said that much publicly at Aswan 2 days before Dr. Kissinger arrived in the Middle East. And so almost this entire bit of shuttle diplomacy was devoted to Dr. Kissinger's attempt to make the Israelis accept again retreat, the gift of land, for various American promises of money and of aid, but for no Arab give, no quo for their quid. The Israelis were saying, when I talked to them, you know, we're being asked to give our land for peace, and they're taking our land for war. And there had developed in Israel, not only among the Likud, the major opposition party, but within the cabinet, Mr. Peres and others, a very strong group of people who I think reflected the mood of the average Israeli far more immediately than did Mr. Rabin. That unless there were meaningful political concessions by Sadat, Israel was not willing to pull back simply because the American Secretary of State wanted to continue to be a hero to the Arab countries of the Middle East. I believe that this last round of negotiations was ill-fated from the beginning. The Israelis are now deeply suspicious of Dr. Kissinger. They no longer think of him as unser uns, but of a cold, clear-eyed, calculating American Secretary of State. And they wonder just how much he can make good, even on the promises that he's making them, if these promises were enough to satisfy them. What were the headlines while Dr. Kissinger was in the Middle East? He came there hoping that Israel would return the oil fields at Abu Rhodes to the Egyptians. And in order to prepare for this eventuality, he had received from the Shah of Iran assurances that there would be a continuing flow of oil from Iranian oil fields to Eilat to meet Israeli needs. But at the very same time that he secured this agreement on the part of the Iranians, Iran had gone to Algeria and signed with Iraq a treaty which in effect destroyed one of the strongest and oldest ethnic minorities in the Middle East, the Kurds. The Kurds are a Muslim mountain people who inhabited the Caucasus in Russia, in Turkey, in Iran, and Iraq. And for over 25 years now, they've been waging war against the Iraqis, for whom they are separated by religion, by tribal allegiance, by politics, by many things. And for many years now, the Iranians have given haven to the Iraqi Kurds, and they've given them money and they've given them military support. But now that the Shah of Iran has a great deal of money, and until his army is as equipped as he might be, he is terribly afraid of the Iraqi, who are good fighters, who are equipped with the latest Russian missiles, supersonic planes and tanks. And so rather than expose his western flank to the Iraqi, he signed a treaty which committed the Kurds to death. As a 2-week ceasefire. But as of April 1, the Iraqis will mount a major attack against the Kurds, and no one in this world will raise a finger to help them. How much then is an Iranian commitment worth? And the other set of headlines which preoccupied the world and the Israelis, of course, during these last weeks of Dr. Kissinger's visit, were those which told of the defeats of the Saigon government in the highlands of South Vietnam, and the defeats of the Cambodian government of Lon Nol in and around the capital Phnom Penh. The Israelis read. And the Israelis wondered just how much Dr. Kissinger could really commit the Senate of the United States to foreign aid, when that Senate was unwilling to make good on commitments apparently made by our administration to Cambodia and to South Vietnam. The day that Dr. Kissinger arrived in Israel, there was a big ad taken out in the front page of the Israeli papers which said, "Welcome Dr. Henry Kissinger, Nobel Prize winner and bringer of peace to Vietnam." And Dosh, one of the fine cartoonists of Israel, had a little strip in which he showed in the bottom corner a wounded South Vietnamese woman crouching her hand around her little son in tatters. And in the background you see villages aflame, death, bodies, corpses, devastation. And she's saying to her boy, "And then a clever man from America came and brought us peace." The Israelis recognized, because of the headlines which surrounded these negotiations, that peace in the mouth of an American Secretary of State means one thing. It means that which is to the advantage of the United States. And it means quite another thing when you speak of peace in terms of those who live in the battle areas. Vietnam has no peace today, but there are no American troops in Vietnam. Cambodia has no peace today, but America is quits in Cambodia. And the Israelis began to speak more and more of what they call the salami tactics of Dr. Kissinger. Dr. Kissinger spoke of ongoing stage-by-stage negotiations. Those are diplomatic words. The Israelis spoke of cutting salami. Little piece, another little piece, another little piece. First in the Sinai, then in the Golan, then in the West Bank, then in Jerusalem, then in Sinai again. Little by little, Israel will be pressured. Time and again, they fell to give up a slice of territory, to lengthen her borders and weaken her defenses in return for what? Because the little piece of salami which will be given will never satisfy the appetite of those to whom it's being given. And so although the Israelis were anxious to come to arrangements with Egypt, they were not prepared to do so simply on the vague promises of a man whom they no longer trusted. A man who they felt could no longer make good on the secret promises he was making them. They needed more. Sadat was unwilling to give it. And apparently the decision which was made in Jerusalem this last week was this: we have nothing more to lose at Geneva than we would have to lose by giving in now. If we give in to Sadat now and give him back the passes and the oil fields for nothing, he'll simply demand a third round of negotiations and we'll be under the same pressures. And Mr. Sadat, the Egyptians, however much they may want peace, because God knows their country is in economic disarray and they need to be able to concentrate on their own domestic problems, Mr. Sadat, his administrators and advisors obviously came to the conclusion that this was a time to stand firm, because America was so committed to her banks and her industries and her automobiles that she would ultimately bring pressures on Israel to do what the Egyptians, the Arabs want without a quid pro quo. That if these negotiations failed, the only unfortunate result for Egypt would be that she would not now get back the oil fields. But the fortunate result would be that there would be an exacerbation of relationships between Jerusalem and Washington. The London Times a few days ago carried an interesting article from Paul Martin, one of its correspondents in Cairo, in which he quotes an unnamed Egyptian official who apparently is their foreign minister to this effect: "The Egyptians have made it known they regard the present phase of the tough talking as primarily concerning the future of relations between Israel and the United States. They see themselves as a fulcrum in attempts by Dr. Kissinger to extract from the Israelis a
a more flexible approach to the question of a new withdrawal on the Egyptian front. If the talks fail, it will create a divergence in American and Israeli policy in the Middle East for the first time since 1954, said this senior Egyptian official. Failure would also bring the first test of American feelings about continuing support for Israel and the cost of this to the United States. Egypt's belief was that American policy was to succeed in the present talks and secure an agreement. Based on this and taking into account the likely consequences for Israel of a failure, the official added that Egypt was confident that the balance would be tipped in favor of an agreement. Well, in the latter case, the official guessed incorrectly. But in the former, it seems clear to me that he will be correct. Even-handedness, the new articulated policy of the United States towards the Middle East, really doesn't mean even-handedness. It means the United States has wanted to have its cake and to eat it too. It's wanted to maintain, for a variety of reasons, its historic relationship with Israel, and it's wanted the oil of the Persian Gulf and the markets of the Arab world. And it's wanted to have all of these, and at the same time not to pay any really meaningful political price. Now the Egyptians feel that having failed to make Israel pay the price of American economic interpenetration of the Middle East, pressures will be brought by the United States on Israel to force her to do so. What will these pressures be? A slowdown in military equipment, a slowdown or reduction of foreign aid, a very quick indication of what will be the America's policy will come when we see the explanation which Dr. Kissinger and others will offer for the failure of these talks. Up till now, he has tended to praise Sadat as flexible, as peace-seeking. If he continues to do so, despite the evidence that Sadat has not given one inch, will be a clear indication that the United States will begin to pressure Israel to pay the cost of American prosperity and American power. How well Israel will react to those pressures and how staunchly she will stand up under them if they come remains to be seen. But it seems clear to me, at least, that as Dr. Kissinger flies back to the United States, the whole question of peace in the Middle East comes to these United States. Ultimately, it'll come to Geneva. But for the moment, it's going to be fought out here. While I was in Israel, I read the announcement that the OPEC nations had bought $3.5 million worth of advertising in the Reader's Digest in order to explain their positions to the American people and to the world. It's very clear that a very sophisticated political propaganda, public relations undertaking is being mounted, well-financed. Certainly they have the money. In order to make Americans recognize what the Arabs want them to recognize. That they can have whatever they want in the Middle East, all the oil and all the trade, all they have to give up is their unbalanced support for Israel. What is unbalanced support for Israel? It means a willingness to give Israel, to sell Israel arms when no one else in the world is willing to sell it to Israel. It means some foreign aid. It means trade. It means unwillingness to bend before the Arab boycott. I'm afraid that the American Jewish community and the American community generally will be besieged on all sides by those who want to change its mind, our mind, about this long history of friendship between our two countries. I think that the Arabs are far too sanguine about the results of their propaganda. I think that Dr. Kissinger will not simply put the blame on Israel. He cannot, in all fairness. He should not. In all justice. But it's very clear that the Arab world is counting on the fact that this present administration in Washington is an administration which represents the business interests of the United States, the fat cats, the big companies, corporations. And it's very clear that these corporations are eager at whatever cost to sell their goods and their services, their tanks and their cars, and their banking services, their engineering to the Middle East. And it's clear that these business people are used to making what they like to call hard business decisions, which means they don't care about the well-being of their employees, and they don't care about the well-being of little countries or little people who stand in their way. The issue is efficiency, effectiveness, profits. You recall that some 3 weeks ago, a group of some 40 corporation executives, presidents of major industries in the United States, industries which represented 10% of the American gross national product, went through the Middle East. And when they came back, they said many things. They went to see the president. The man who's president of Ford Motor Company said at that meeting, or so it's reported, "Mr. President, I want you to know only one thing. That if there is another oil embargo, that will be the end of the American automobile industry as we've known it." And the President of the United States is a former congressman from Michigan. The President of the United States has long lived in the closest harmony with the automobile world. That world, the banking world of his vice president, and the oil world, have a tremendous impact upon our policy. I think the average person in the United States understands that the Arab oil embargo and the fourfold increase in oil costs are not simply a matter of bringing up an underpriced resource to adequate levels, but have been a form of piracy and gouging of the worst kind. I think they recognize that Israel wants peace and the Arabs have been intransigent. The policy is rarely made on humanitarian grounds or even on the grounds of public opinion. It's made by those who have power for their own special interests. Frankly, one of my major concerns is just whose interests this particular administration will be concerned with. That's not clear. The shape of American policy now that Israel has for the first time said no remains to be seen. Certainly from the Israeli point of view, it's going to be a time of testing. And I think the Israelis are rather glad for the test, rather earlier than later, rather when their equipment is in place than when their equipment will be obsolete, rather now than when they are even more tired than they are at the moment. I found the Israelis not so much tense, anxious, as simply tired. The one difference in the landscape you see only at night. And as you walk through the neighborhoods or walk down the streets in front of public gathering places, you'll see two by two older citizens with a gun on their back, the home guard. The night now is divided into three watches, and every part of the country is divided into sentry areas. And men and women, the older yeshuv, the people beyond military age, each take a watch two or three times a week. They patrol the side streets. They walk by the homes and the schools. They look for unexpected objects, sticks of dynamite, people who ought not to be abroad at night. And each night, one or two such objects is found. It reminded me very much of the stories of the Home Guard in Great Britain during the Second World War, who were guarding against parachute attack. I doubt that they are militarily very effective. I suspect that most of these guns aren't even loaded. But this silent, patient walking through the neighborhood by people who are determined to maintain life in as normal a way as they can is a sign to me of Israel 1975. It's an Israel very much unlike the Israel of a year or two or three ago. It's tense, drawn together,
feels a sense of purpose, besieged by inflation. Everybody's working 2, 3, 4 jobs. There's no security about tomorrow. A student starts a course and he's called up for military duty. A man begins inventory and he's mobilized. 2, 3 times in the course of every year, everybody's brought into the army for a week or a month, 6 weeks at a time. It's a country which is fully mobilized and tired of being mobilized. There's no other alternative. And somehow, for the most part, they've accepted the tensions far more gracefully than I suspect you and I could. Fortunately, though they had a few good years, they didn't get that spoiled. And they can walk the streets at night and work the long day, the 50-year-olds and the 60-year-olds and the 70-year-olds. And they can see their children called up to the army and know that some of them will die, know that there's a cost, and somehow not complain. You feel humbled by the country. And I, for one, found this time a new sense of possibility. They've begun to take in hand some of the very serious social and economic and political problems which faced them. There was a new tax reform bill just submitted and passed by the Knesset, one to close once and for all the various tax loopholes in that society. There's serious work now towards educational reform, which God knows is overdue in that country. There's serious talk about electoral reform. The Israelis are concerned not only to survive, but about the quality of their lives. And that concern comes out in conversation and gives you encouragement. Unfortunately, there's still things to laugh about. When I was in Israel, the best laugh that was around had to do with the weeds that are growing in the interstices of the stones of the Western Wall. You won't believe it, but the Sephardic Orthodox rabbinate and the Ashkenazic Orthodox rabbinate have got themselves into an incredibly complex, difficult, rabbinic, Talmudic debate about whether or not somebody could put a ladder and climb up and pull those weeds. The Sephardim say you can. The Ashkenazim say don't dare. Sermons are being preached in every shul in Israel about those famous few weeds growing in the Western Wall. It's good to have something not consequential to be involved with. It's good for a country to get back to basics.
The age of luxury is behind them. The age when everybody saw they'd have an American car, an American television set, and the newest electronic equipment. The only people that you see in restaurants in Israel are tourists. The only people who can afford expensive clothes are tourists. Inflation is rampant. It's incredibly, costs are incredibly high. Taxes are incredibly high. The young generation is studying as best it can, preparing itself with confidence towards the future. This last Sabbath, called Shabbat HaGadol, Great Sabbath. When redemption comes, according to some traditions in our history, on this great Sabbath, there'll be the Atchila Digulta, the beginning of a redemption. It's for that reason that the promises of redemptive promises of God as spoken through the prophet Malachi are read in the synagogue on this Sabbath. The Sabbath when Israel thinks of hope, redemption from Egyptian slavery and from redemption from the insecurities of history. I don't know whether the events of the last several days are the beginning of a redemptive act. As I came in this morning, everybody said, isn't the news dark? And my answer was no, I didn't feel that it was.
I think that this was a very important decision by Israel, long overdue, to assert its own priorities, prerogatives, to do as much as it can and with the limits of its power to make the world listen to Israel's needs, as well as to those of the others. It may be a disastrous decision. A few months might have been bought, a few months which may not be. But what really does Israel have to fear when it is ganged up on at Geneva, which it doesn't have to fear from the present step-by-step negotiations? There's no assurance, dear friends, that security, peace, non-belligerency will come soon to the Middle East. If anything, the events of the last 2 weeks, Mr. Sadat's decision to play the hard line, makes one wonder whether there will be any kind of non-belligerency in the near future in that part of the world. No one knows, and God knows the Israelis want peace. Will it come? We can only pray. Let me close with a vignette. It really doesn't sum up what I've said, but it sums up the spirit of Israel, the spirit which gives me encouragement and confidence. The line which was told me by Miriam Lycan's brother. Miriam Lycan has a delightful brother who retired from the American service, librarian in Washington, several years ago. He went to live in Israel. He was an expert in history of medicine. And he brought to Israel his library, and he was promised by Israel that he would have a room at the medical school in Tel Aviv near his books, and he could act as the librarian for these books and do his writing. And he looked forward to that kind of retirement. Well, since he's been in Israel, he's had to teach a few courses, and he's had to go to the schools and teach them how to be a librarian. And his life has taken off, and he told me he's far busier than he ever expected to be. He made a trip back to the United States. And he went to see some of the men with whom he'd worked in the federal government for years, who retired to St. Petersburg and to Sun City and to places like that. And they said to them, how could you go to Israel? Here we are. We play golf every day. We sit. We're quiet. We're secure. And he said, you know what I told them? He said, I told them that one thing is for sure. In Israel, I'll never die of boredom. It's never boring to be in Israel. It's always encouraging. It's always humbling. You touch their humanity, the basics, people. There's no sham. There's no pretense. You recognize more clearly, you know, what life is really all about.